protest is a critical part of any democratic society. Social movements take to the streets to make their activism seen and heard, which often draws anger from those in power, such as what's happening over in Hong Kong. Now, recently in Australia, there have been more state laws designed to crack down on people protesting and prevent assembly. This includes an attempt by Brisbane City Council last week to stop a street protest. At the same time, activists have become more vocal in protesting the lack of action on climate crisis, with groups such as Extinction Rebellion leading civil disobedience and school strikes worldwide. To discuss all of this, we're joined by Aidan Ricketts, a law lecturer from Southern Cross University and environmental activist. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
No worries. Good morning.
So, Aidan, is the right to protest actually protected by law in Australia?
No. I'll try to give you the shortest answer to that, but we don't have a Bill of Rights in our Constitution, nor do we even have a Bill of Rights by legislation at the federal level. So, consequently, the right to protest is of a very sort of ambiguous and shadowy nature in Australia and is more or less protected by tradition, you know, within the common law tradition, within the traditions of our democratic system. It's more like a democratic convention and something that we pay, you know, respect to.
Mm-hmm.
We are a party to a number of international covenants that respect the right to protest, but they are not instantly enforceable in domestic law. And then finally, within the Constitution, the High Court has found an implied freedom of political communication, which can, in some instances, assist in knocking out legislation which really infringes that. But it's limited, and very much it's focused on political communication rather than protest itself.
So if we're looking at this attempt by the Brisbane City Council to stop a street protest, that's pretty legal as far as all that goes.
That fits within you know, a reasonably familiar procedure that a lot of states have, where when you're going to have a protest that will, for example, disrupt traffic, you can apply for a permit to do so. And the permit will be granted on conditions, but if it's refused, it can go to court.
Right.
So that was the Brisbane City Council using a right they had to try to ban the protest, but then the court didn't think their reasons were good enough.
Mm-hmm. And Aidan, what is the danger of legislation that cracks down on protest actions?
Well, look, it's sort of a race to the bottom, because what we've been seeing, you know, we already have public order laws which prevent, you know, the obstruction of traffic, the obstruction of vehicles, trespass, things like that. What we've been seeing increasingly in the last few years is anti-protest laws themselves. So Tasmania sort of kicked off with laws to protect mining and logging, and they set up offences which can only really be committed by people who were protesting, so they were specifically anti-protest. Western Australia, I'll get on to Western Australia in a minute. New South Wales introduced a number of anti-protest laws in response, really, to the coal mining and coal seam gas campaigns, and so they've massively increased the fines for trespass. They've made lock-on devices capable of being seized by police in New South Wales, and have also expanded move-on powers. So what we're seeing is an endless increase in police powers in any case, coupled with very specific laws trying to wind back the right of protest. Now, Western Australia attempted to do what Queensland is now proposing to do, which is introduce offences of possessing or using lock-on devices in protest.
Mm-hmm.
It was thoroughly condemned even by the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, as well as by human rights groups in Australia. And it was very controversial, but then there was a change of government. The Labor Party was incoming to power in 2018, something like that.
Yep.
And so the laws lapsed, really. But we've got the in a strange situation in Queensland, where it's actually a Labor government proposing these laws. Now, when we've seen these laws proposed in New South Wales, Tasmania and Western Australia, we've seen, you know, the Labor Party oppose them because of its, you know, union history, I suppose, and understanding of the need for the right to protest.
Yeah.
And then suddenly in Queensland, with this flavour of, you know, trying to support the coal industry no matter what,
well, I mean,
we're seeing this...
I mean, on the point about, you know, you talked about coal mining and logging. In your opinion, why has there been a surge of legislation that seems targeted against specifically environmental protests?
Because of the power of the vested interests that they're against, I would say. I mean, you know, I was following the logging protests for many years in New South Wales, and they didn't tend to lead to, despite, you know, a huge amount of protesting and a huge amount of change, they didn't tend to lead to special legislation, mm-hmm. partly because although the logging industry is influential, it's nowhere near as influential as the mining and fossil fuel industry.
Right.
But the mining and fossil fuel industry have a, you know, a very, very long history of having extremely privileged access to government, you know, major donations to both sides of politics for decades and decades and decades. And so when you really, and they were really pretty much unaffected by protest until the rise of Lock the Gate in particular, and now things like Frontline Action on mm-hmm. coal and Extinction Rebellion that are really, because of climate change, the focus has swung right around onto coal mining and onto coal seam gas.
Right. So they're working hard to defend those.
Yes, and I think they've taken, you know, terrible offence at the idea of, you know, I mean, when you've sort of got privileged access to parliamentary democracy to suddenly have it rise up on the streets and oppose
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
I think the immediate response is to go back to Parliament and say, hey, we need new laws to stop these people protesting against mines and mining.
So Aidan, on the flip side of this, from your personal experience as an activist, what are the changes you've seen these protests bring about, specifically the environmental ones?
The logging protests in New South Wales, for example, were extremely successful. The North East Forest Alliance ran campaigns from about 1989 through to the early 2000s, quadrupled the size of the National Parks estate and achieved preservation of a lot of old growth and high conservation value forest. And, you know, whenever we look back on history, there tends to be this almost consensus that, oh, yes, you know, it really is good that those protesters made that stand at the time and protected those forests or protected the Franklin River, you know, or Kakadu, you know, or the Daintree, you know. Mm-hmm. We always tend to look back with a bit of hindsight and go, oh, well, yes, they were right, of course. But somehow we don't seem to be able to bring that into the present and go, well, what do you think we're going to be thinking about the Adani coal mine in 20 years' time?
Well, you know, if we're even still around to, you know, worry about it.
Well, that's right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for clarifying this issue for us, Aidan.
Yeah, the thing I was going to mention, the Queensland laws yeah. are aiming to criminalise the possession and use of lock-on devices. And one of the things, you know, that I think people need to understand about lock-on devices, in my opinion and my experience, they make protests a lot more effective and a lot safer. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of having a, you know, a group of people linked arms confronting a line of police, it leads to a melee, it leads to a struggle straight away. But the beautiful thing with lock-ons, people are able to make a very, very peaceful statement by locking onto a gate or mm-hmm. something like that. And the police turn up and it's a very calm situation. It's like, oh, this is what we need to deal with. You all stand over here, we'll unlock it. So, you know, as much as lock-ons help protests to be effective and they, you know, cause delays, I think, you know, we're heading down a, you know,
more violent,
much more difficult path if
yeah.
we get rid of them. I mean, lock-ons are as old as, you know, the suffragettes or older. And when you think about it, what could be more a statement of non-violence than a person to just lock up their own arms and put themselves in such a vulnerable
yeah.
position to make a statement? I mean, how could that person possibly be violent?
Absolutely.
If they're
unlocked up? Yeah.
You know, so I think we've really got to sort of respect the role, both the symbolic role of lock-ons in non-violence, but actually their practical role in actually, you know, keeping protests sort of just orderly and predictable in a way, because, you know, I don't think the police really, I think the police actually benefit from the use of lock-ons, because the crowd mm-hmm. can go, oh, well, there's the person locked on, you deal with that, and we'll just, you know, chant or sing or do whatever we do.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Aidan, for helping us with this.
No worries.
All right, thank you. And that was Aidan Ricketts, a law lecturer from Southern Cross University.